program begins in 60 seconds.
The content of the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. Now, it's time for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here, we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week, we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Call in between 12:30 and 1 p.m. on Sundays and present your case to our experts. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now, our host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
The Focus on Females Radio Health Care Clinic is on, and we thank you for listening. A special message to Focus on Females fans. Our health and medical education programs, including this radio clinic, is financially sponsored by the not-for-profit 501c3 Focus on Females Education Foundation. In this difficult economic time, our donations are way down. Presently, we do not have the funds to continue this radio show past the summer. If this show or the annual Focus on Females Healthcare Symposium has made a difference to you, or if you are comforted in knowing that you can turn to us as a live, ready, reliable resource every Sunday, then now is the time to show your appreciation. Please send donations to the Focus on Females Education Foundation, Post Office Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679. That's 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679. And we thank you for your support. Today we're tackling prostate cancer with guest expert Dr. Chandler Dora, urologist, with St. Joseph's Hospital in Tampa, Florida. But first, this radio show and the free annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, now the largest in the country with over 1,000 women during each of our last two events, with a combined 7,500 hours of education on those 2 days, is supported, as indicated before, by the not-for-profit Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission is to create an interactive, dynamic, community-based healthcare safety net, making you an expert on your personal medical needs. The result? Better partnering with your existing doctor, leading to more effective office visits, faster results, and a reduced economic burden of avoidable medical and emergency care. We do save lives and protect families through the immediate impact of direct with the expert health education. And as mentioned, today we are tackling prostate cancer with urologist Dr. Chandler Dora. And Chandler, it's nice to have you here today.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Maskin.
Chandler has graduated from the University of Florida in Gainesville with summa cum laude, with a Phi Beta Kappa and a Bachelor of Science in Neurobiology. He then earned his medical degree from the University of Miami, Leonard Miller School of Medicine. He was selected to the Medical School Honor Society, the AOA Alpha Omega Alpha, and graduated with research distinction. Dr. Dora received his training in urologic surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. served as chief resident associate and clinical instructor in urology at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. While at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Dora participated in clinical and basic science research in urology and was awarded first place in the Minnesota Urologic Society Essay Competition and a 2004 AUA Gerald Murphy Scholar in Urology. Dr. Dora was in group practice in Naples, Florida for 2 years prior to opening his solo practice. He is board certified by the American Board of Urology. Dr. Dora has multiple publications and national presentations in various disciplines within urology. His areas of interest include prostate cancer, bladder cancer, and benign enlargement of the prostate. But he is well-versed in all areas of urology and urologic surgery, including female urology and incontinence. So, we begin at the beginning, the prostate. Chandler, what is the prostate? Where is it located? What is its function?
Well, the prostate is a gland that's located around the outlet of the bladder, and its primary function is actually for producing nutrients for the sperm to survive outside of the body. So primarily it functions during reproduction, and it's considered part of the reproductive system. And after men are no longer producing children, then it's mainly just becomes a nuisance.
Okay. So let me ask, so the urethra passes through the prostate, is that correct?
Yes.
All right, so if you would, trace the urine production, and you can start with the basic with the kidney. The blood circulates through the kidney and go from there.
Sure. The blood circulates through the kidneys. It's filtered by the nephrons, which are the smallest unit of the kidney, and urine is produced. It passes down the ureters, which are small muscular tubes that go between the kidney and the bladder. It collects in the bladder, usually for 2 to 3 hours at a time, and then it's expelled out the urethra, which is the tube that you urinate out of. And the prostate is at a critical location because when it becomes enlarged, it pinches off the outflow to the bladder, and it can make life fairly miserable.
Okay, so as you mentioned, the prostate is located at the exit of the bladder as the urethra passes through it on the way out. Is that correct?
Yes, I tell people they pee through the prostate just like you would pee through a donut hole.
Okay. Now, what's the normal size of a prostate? I imagine it grows with age. So
yes.
Let's compare a 20-year-old man versus, well, let's just make it very plain. Women do not have prostates.
Correct.
Okay, because as you indicated already, it's involved with the reproductive system and the man.
Yes.
So, all right, so let's compare, for example, a 20-year-old man versus a 80-year-old man. If you can give just a rough estimate of the size. This is normal without any type of abnormal growth or cancer.
Yes, so the prepubertal prostate is virtually non-existent, and as a boy goes through adolescence, by the time he's in his 20s, the prostate is about the size of a grape or so, and then normal prostate in the adult male in his 40s would be probably about the size of a walnut.
Okay.
And then for unknown reasons, in certain men as they get older, they can take off in growth, and some can become the size of a lemon, an orange, over time.
Wow, and that's serious enlargement.
Yes, it creates a lot of mayhem when they become that big.
When it's that big, is it? Well, obviously, when you look at an enlarged prostate, obviously, let's go through the reasons. Let's go that route. The reasons why one would get an enlarged prostate, obviously, cancer. If you would list the other possibilities and the differential.
I always tell men that really the only known risk factor for the prostate enlarging is really age and the male gender. So we know that the prostate does get larger with age, and obviously we know it only affects men. But as far as racial differences in the incidence of BPH...
Now let's define BPH.
I'm sorry, benign prostatic hyperplasia.
Okay, and when you say these the prostate grows from a grape in the man's 20s to a walnut, lemon, potentially an orange. If it gets that big and it's not cancer, is it defined as BPH at that point?
Yes.
By definition? Can it get enlarged with just through inflammation to be that size and not be from BPH?
It generally can't get to the size, the extreme sizes, just from inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
It can become probably enlarged 10% of its 10% greater than its normal size through inflammation. But usually it doesn't go to these extreme measures through inflammation alone. And the only real way to, by definition, determine whether something's BPH or benign enlargement versus other causes is through a prostate biopsy.
Okay. All right. So it's amazing that it can grow to that extent to a completely benign process. I mean, that's quite impressive. Do we understand why in some cases, in some patients, it grows to such a large extent and not in other men?
We don't know that. There is research going on, obviously, in various laboratories around the country, basic science research to determine what are the mitogenic or enlarging factors for the prostate, but we really don't know yet.
Okay. All right, so, and of course, the symptoms of enlarged prostate, because as you mentioned, it kind of wraps around the urethra as the urethra exits the bladder. As it enlarges, it can impinge upon the urethra and thereby the flow of urine out through the body, through the urethra and out through the body. So typical symptoms, if you would review, of any enlarged prostate would be what?
Typical symptoms, and these are symptoms that we ask men about in the office, would be and we generally break them down into two categories, obstructive symptoms and irritative symptoms. And obstructive symptoms that men generally have would be slow stream, intermittency of stream, or the stream starting and stopping, hesitancy, meaning you have to stand there for a long time to get the stream started. And then you have the more irritative symptoms would be nocturia, or getting up a lot at night to urinate. Urgency, where you have to get to the bathroom quickly or you feel like you're going to lose the urine, and frequency, meaning you're going often. And so men usually have a combination of these symptoms. Some can have purely obstructive, some can have purely irritative, and they can both be from the same disease process.
Okay. Now, so these symptoms can occur from any cause of an enlarged prostate.
Correct.
So let's talk about prostate cancer in particular. First off, let's just make it clear. Is benign prostatic hyperplasia a sign of cancer? Let's just make that clear.
No.
That it is not. Okay.
Those are two distinct disease processes, and you can have one or you can have both, and they can coexist in the same man.
Okay. All right, so that's important. Clearly, if those people that have been treated for BPH or benign prostatic hyperplasia in the past with, say, a TURP or other modes of therapy to resect the majority of that prostate are still at risk to develop prostate cancer in the future.
Correct. Those men still need to undergo screening.
Okay, because there's still some prostate left behind after a treatment for BPH.
Yes, in general, the treatments for BPH are directed at the center of the prostate, which is the glandular component, and the cancer typically develops in the peripheral zone of the prostate or the outer portion of the prostate.
I might mention this time that we did a show on benign prostatic hypertrophy on May 23rd, and for those that are interested in reviewing that as well, go to our website, focusonfemales.com, and on the left lower corner is a link to our Radio Health Show clinic page where you can pull up a podcast. Just go to the 2010 year and then scroll down to May 23rd, and you can pull up the podcast on benign prostatic hypertrophy or hyperplasia and listen to that show. We're going to take a quick break. Before we do, I'll give you the phone numbers again to call in with your questions. We will spend the rest of the time on prostate cancer after we've given this kind of introduction. The phone number to call in is 289-1860, 289-1860. Everywhere else outside of Hillsborough County, it's 877-969-8600, 877-969-8600. It's prostate cancer. Be right back.
Unhappy with your child's school? Looking for a more effective option? Get the small classroom atmosphere and caring teachers without the private school price at Imagine Schools in St. Petersburg, a public charter K-7 tuition-free school. Imagine Schools is open to any student eligible to attend Pinellas County Schools. With the arrival of new principal Angela Prince, teachers and parents are excited about the school's new direction and restored vision, where learning becomes fun and college is an expectation taught at an early age. Placing your children in Imagine Schools helps them grow in achievement, initiative, and leadership, preparing the way for a brighter future. Imagine Schools is one of the fastest growing charter schools in the country, giving you a better choice. Enrollment is filling fast, so call now, 727-821-7100. That's 727-821-7100. Imagine Schools at 1950 First Avenue North, St. Petersburg. Online at ImagineSchoolsStPetersburg.com. Enroll your child now.
Believe it or not, the back-to-school rush is right around the corner. It may also be hard for you to believe that when school starts next month, there will be over 5,800 homeless children in our community starting the school year unprepared and empty-handed. That's where you come in. WGUL has once again teamed up with Feed the Children, an organization that distributes backpacks full of age-appropriate school supplies to homeless elementary and middle school students around the country. With your help, we are seeking to put 1,000 backpacks on the empty hooks in classrooms around the Tampa Bay area. Your gift of just $100 will provide backpacks filled with school supplies, as well as food and personal items for homeless children living right here in our area. Please call 877-714-5437. That's 714-KIDS, and help make a difference in the life of a child. That's 877-714-5437. Give online at 860WGUL.com.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit FocusOnFemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, this is Dr. Steve Maskin. I am with Dr. Chandler Dora, urologist with St. Joseph's Hospital here in Tampa, Florida, and he is a specialist on prostate cancer. We've talked about introductory issues regarding the prostate and the benign condition, benign prostatic hyperplasia, BPH, which is a frequent diagnosis in patients, male patients with symptoms of obstructive urologic problems. Another cause of obstructive outflow of urine is prostate cancer. Let's talk, Chandler, if we can, about, first off, some of the risk factors of prostate cancer.
The risk factors that we generally look for are family history is very important. So if you have one first-degree relative, such as your dad or one of your brothers who is affected with prostate cancer, you're about twice as likely to get prostate cancer. If you have two first-degree relatives, I see some men whose dad and brother has had prostate cancer, and those men are up to 10 times more likely to get prostate cancer than the average man. So family history is a big one. Race, we know that African-American men tend to be affected with higher grade and more aggressive cancers. Even when matched with Caucasian counterparts for socioeconomic issues. And there's been a lot of work done in Detroit through the Henry Ford system on that.
We don't know why that is yet.
We don't know why that is, but in African-American men, generally, we start screening at the age of 40 instead of 50.
And that's a very important point, and we'll come back to talk more about screening after we talk about risk factors.
Okay.
So age, race, family history, how about environmental factors?
That's somewhat controversial. I mean, I think that we recognize that there probably are some dietary issues because the rates of prostate cancer in people who are of Scandinavian descent tend to be far higher than people of Asian descent. And most likely that has to do with dietary issues or other complex genetic issues.
How about does excessive sunlight play a role?
There has been some work on vitamin D, which would probably be the indirect relationship to sunlight.
Is vitamin D being protective in some way?
Yes.
Is that? But we don't. That has not been worked out. The pathway of that protective effect has not yet been worked out.
No. And there's been other vitamin or dietary things worked on, selenium and vitamin E. There was a large trial called the SELECT trial, which enrolled tens of thousands of men, which actually was closed early because selenium or vitamin E was found to have no protective effect against prostate cancer.
No protective effect.
Correct.
With selenium or vitamin E. Okay.
Correct.
And how about the medications? I came across something in my prep for this show about the statin drugs.
Yes, there's some preliminary data to suggest that statin drugs, and by that meaning cholesterol medications such as atorvastatin or simvastatin that many men are commonly on, may have a protective effect against prostate cancer. It's not to the point yet where we could recommend it for prevention of prostate cancer, but it may have some protective effect.
How about exercise, smoking? Would potentially improve one's or reduce one's risk if one were to exercise and reduce or eliminate smoking?
Yes, there may be some connection between body weight and prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Exercise may serve you well in preventing prostate cancer. And smoking is related to just about every tumor system. Not as strongly with prostate cancer as it is with bladder cancer, for instance, or with kidney cancer, renal cell carcinoma. But, any cancer is generally related to smoking.
I'm looking at this article from the Wall Street Journal back on quite recently, June 29th, 2010, entitled The Prostate Cancer Quandary. And in it, it refers to five recent studies about statins that appear to lower the risk for advanced prostate cancer. So stay tuned for that. Statin drugs seem to have a limited risk associated with it.
Yes, and they may have a protective effect even beyond their cholesterol-lowering ability with regard to cardiovascular disease.
So let's now talk about screening. Let's say one has a risk factor of prostate cancer, African-American, in that subgroup, it's recommended to begin screening at age of 40. In non-African-American and without family history, without any of the risk factors, I believe the age to begin screening is 50.
Correct.
Is that correct? Okay, so let's say we're at that point and we need to begin screening. What do you recommend your patients? How do you recommend your patients to begin screening?
Okay. Well, before I address that, just to get to the your question, it depends on who you talk to as far as whether you screen at all, what age you begin screening. If you listen to a lot of the governing bodies in preventative medicine, the American Cancer Society, American Academy of Family Physicians do not recommend screening on a population basis for prostate cancer, but the American Urological Association recommends screening beginning at 40.
For those with high risk?
Even for everybody, actually. Okay. They recently changed their position and went the opposite direction of the other governing bodies and have recommended that all men begin screening at the age of 40 with a baseline PSA and a finger examination.
Now we're talking about finger examination. We're talking about a digital rectal exam.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's just call that a DRE.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
And you had asked what is the screening, and that's generally the screening. It consists of two things. It consists of a PSA, which is a blood test, and it consists of a digital rectal examination, which is where the examiner basically just sticks the finger in the backside and feels the prostate.
And it is it is such that the anatomy of the human body is the best way to get to palpate or get to touch the prostate.
Correct.
And now a question.
Interestingly, from an anatomic standpoint, the area of the prostate which is most prone to cancer is directly adjacent to the rectum. It's the peripheral zone of the prostate. So,
which is an excellent point. When you do a digital rectal exam, you cannot engage the entire prostate.
Correct.
So how much of the prostate can you typically touch and examine with a digital rectal examination? How much of that walnut can you get around?
I would say about 60% typically.
Okay. And what percentage of prostate cancers are in that 60%?
85%.
All right. So there's still a possibility that that test alone could miss 15% of prostate cancers.
Absolutely. If you have a cancer that's starting in the central zone of the prostate, or if you have a cancer which has not yet reached a size which is palpable, then you can miss it with the finger examination alone, and that's where the blood test comes into play.
That's why the emphasis of something additional to the digital rectal examination for screening and for
Correct.
Evaluation. Okay, so tell us something about the blood test, the PSA. What, you know, what does it stand for? What does it look at, and its usefulness or potentially why it can be misleading?
The PSA, it stands for prostate-specific antigen, and it was developed in the late 80s, became broadly applied in the 90s, and it actually serves a purpose in healthy men. If you measure the levels of PSA in semen, it's extremely high, and what it does is when the sperm is outside the body, it's an enzyme that cuts protein and liquefies the semen. So if you leave a sperm sample out in a cup, it basically turns into water over the course of 10-15 minutes because this PSA enzyme is active in cleaving these proteins. What occurs in prostate cancer is you get the disorderly growth of prostate glands, and instead of the PSA exiting in an orderly fashion out through the ducts and out into the sperm, it has nowhere to go, so it's released into the bloodstream, and that's when you get elevation in PSA.
Hmm. So there's an excess amount of PSA that's being synthesized by the cells in the glands of the prostate, and it's not being secreted because it overwhelms the cells and it's released and picked up into the surrounding tissue and picked up by the bloodstream.
Correct.
Okay. All right, and. So any, as you pointed out earlier, therefore any condition which accelerates or increases the synthesis of this PSA can find elevated PSA in the bloodstream, not necessarily the cancer.
Correct. Let's say if you have prostate infection or prostatitis, the glandular component becomes inflamed, and then you have leak from the membranes of the cell, and PSA can be leaked out into the bloodstream, instead of going in an orderly fashion out the ductwork. That's another reason why PSA can become elevated.
So now, can you get the levels, or should I say the levels of PSA in prostatitis and prostate cancer, can they be similar? Can one, does one usually exceed the other?
Generally, the PSAs that you see in men who have a bad case of prostatitis, I've seen men with PSAs in the 20s and 30s from that. But generally, if it gets much higher than that, you're you're probably not dealing with prostatitis alone. Now, the normal, just for screening purposes in men who have no symptoms, you want the PSA to be under 4.
Okay. Now, if it's under 4, and again, I've read, and this is where we're going to get into some confusing areas perhaps. Can you still have prostate cancer even though you have a prostate specific antigen of say under 4?
Yes, about a quarter of men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer have a normal PSA. So these are men who are discovered basically on digital rectal exam alone to have an abnormality.
And just to look at it from the devil's advocate position, if you have a normal PSA and you have a cancer that's in the central part of the gland, then where you can't feel upon digital rectal exam, those patients are picked up how?
They will typically be discovered when the cancer becomes large and palpable.
Okay.
Eventually, most prostate cancers, even if they start off in the central zone, you'll be able to feel them when they get large enough.
The cancers in the central zone, are they is it likely that they will cause symptoms earlier than the ones in the posterior?
Yes.
Okay, so perhaps then, men need to be aware of changes in their urinary habits.
Correct.
And so, all right, so let's take a patient, for example, who has a change in the urinary habits. Digital rectal exam seems normal. The PSA seems okay. What do you recommend?
Obviously, I'm going to assume that man has been examined by a urologist.
Correct.
And I basically, at that point, talk to them about how much their symptoms bother them. And for the most part, men with enlargement of the prostate or BPH, it's a lifestyle condition. So if their symptoms bother them sufficiently, then we treat them. There are men at the extreme end of the spectrum who will get into trouble with retaining large amounts of urine, not being able to pee at all, having the urine back up into their kidneys. Obviously, those men definitely need treatment.
But how about those that have cancer, prostate cancer, and just by virtue of the location of the cancer, and it cannot be picked up by rectal examination, and their PSA is low. At what point does one recommend a biopsy, for example? Again, assuming they're having symptoms, though.
If they undergo a procedure for the enlargement of the prostate, then oftentimes tissue is removed at that time and sent to the pathologist, and the cancer would be discovered at that time.
Is there any indication for a needle biopsy?
Yes.
Was it called a transrectal?
Yes. If a transrectal needle biopsy is something we typically do in the office, and the indications for that are generally abnormal rectal examination, so if you feel something abnormal, or if someone has an elevated PSA.
When you do a transrectal biopsy of the prostate, can you get into the central portion?
Yes.
So you have access to the areas of the prostate that you cannot access with a rectal examination.
Yes. Generally, the peripheral zone or the area where most cancers arise is a fairly thin rim of tissue. So with any transrectal needle biopsy, you're going to be sampling the central zone of the prostate as well.
We're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk more about diagnosis and treatment. And I encourage each of you listening to call in with your question if there's a specific aspect of prostate cancer diagnosis, treatment that you're looking for a breakthrough on. We're here to help you. So now's the time to call in with your specific questions so we can help. Our number is 289-1860, 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Outside of Hillsborough County, it's 877, that's toll free, 877-969-8600. We're here for you. Be right back.
So where can you showcase your business, network with potential customers, and strike up relationships with possible new vendors all under one roof? How about the 2010 Business to Business Showcase, presented by the St. Pete Times? This Thursday evening, 5 to 7 at the St. Petersburg Marriott Clearwater. Bring plenty of business cards to exchange and enter to win terrific prizes. Exhibitors' tables are available, and admission is free when you pre-register today at 727-388-7530 or online at business.stpete.com. Every year, homeless children go back to school with no supplies or backpacks. When families can't afford these items, the child's chances for learning are severely hindered. That's where you come in. Together with Feed the Children, you can help provide kids with the supplies they need to be successful in school this year. Your gift of just $20 will help a child return to school ready to learn and prepared for a better future. Call 877-714-KIDS to give today. That's 877-714-KIDS.
Victimized by illegal immigration, Arizona is fighting to protect its citizens. Instead of enforcing the law and strengthening the border, the Obama administration is encouraging an irresponsible boycott. Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. Our friends at Town Hall have created ArizonaStrong.com. Log on today to sign our free petition and show your support for the rule of law in Arizona. Say no to states and cities that want to boycott Arizona. Keep Arizona strong. Join with us and declare your solidarity at ArizonaStrong.com. That's ArizonaStrong.com.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit FocusOnFemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
For the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is ophthalmologist and eye surgeon Dr. Stephen L. Maskin. Dr. Maskin is the medical director of the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, the proud sponsor of today's show. At the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, Dr. Maskin specializes in solving difficult dry eye and cornea disorders with patients traveling from over 35 states and 5 continents for his evaluation. He has written a best-selling, award-winning book, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome, published by Yale University Press. Dr. Maskin manages dry eye disorders using, when needed, innovative medical and surgical therapies, including the use of placenta-derived amniotic membrane, a new patent-pending natural eye lubricant to provide relief for dry eye sufferers, an exciting new procedure to unblock obstructed tear glands, and a topical cure for eye surface cancer. Dr. Maskin has successfully managed difficult dry eye cases for over 20 years and is board-certified, fellowship-trained, and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and American Academy of Ophthalmology. He has been selected a Best Doctor in America every year from 2000 through 2010. And as an America's Top Ophthalmologist by Consumers Research Council of America, we hope the Focus on Females education programs, including this show, will help you and your family find the health care that works for you. Focus on Females believes in saving lives and protecting families. And please visit drmaskin.com. And if you have not found relief for your painful red, dry eyes, come in to see Dr. Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where comfortable eyes lead to restored lives.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin. Focus.
Okay, welcome back. We're talking about prostate cancer with urologist Dr. Chandler Dora, associated with St. Joseph's Hospital here in Tampa, Florida. We went through some introductory remarks, talked a little bit about risk factors and screening. On screening, we talked about digital rectal examination and PSA, prostate-specific antigen. I want to talk a little more about prostate-specific antigen and some new parameters that are being looked at to help guide evaluation of prostate cancer, and that's PSA density and PSA velocity. And Chandler, if you'd be able to just comment on what those are and when should one request having those performed.
Okay. A PSA velocity refers to how quickly the PSA is changing. And obviously to know that information, you have to have more than one data point or more than one PSA over a certain period of time. And and that's useful both in the screening realm, meaning men who have not been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and it's useful in men who have been diagnosed with prostate cancer and we're following them for remission purposes. But we generally don't like a PSA to go up by more than 0.7 in any given year. So let's say a man starts off with a PSA of 1, which is well below the threshold of 4 for biopsy, and then the next year at their annual physical, they've gone up to 1.8. Well, that man has still not crossed over the threshold for biopsy from an overall PSA standpoint, but that man would be recommended to have a biopsy typically because his PSA velocity has gone up significantly.
So prostate cancer is more likely to cause a rapid rise in the PSA than BPH. Is
correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'd say that those things always have to be interpreted with caution. And there are certainly men who his PSA has gone from 1 to 1.8 over the course of a year. Perhaps in talking to them, I find out that they had sexual activity within 24 hours of having the PSA done. And so sometimes I'll have men repeat that PSA before we cross the bridge of performing prostate biopsy.
Well, that's a very important piece of information there that I've never heard before. So you're suggesting that when men have their PSAs tested, they should not have sexual activity for the previous 24 hours?
It's actually 48 hours is what we recommend.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, good.
And there's, I think that in general, there's not anything wrong with repeating a PSA and getting another data point prior to embarking on a prostate biopsy, unless it's a situation where it's obvious that the PSA is very high or the patient has a highly suspicious rectal examination, then we can proceed with biopsy. But there's certainly nothing wrong with getting another data point.
Mm. And as we mentioned before, prostatitis can also cause a sudden or quick rise in PSA elevation.
Correct. And at times, if men have symptoms suggestive of prostatitis, such as a lot of frequency, urgency, burning with urination, fevers, then we will treat them with a course of antibiotics and repeat the PSA.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us about PSA density and the importance of that test.
PSA density is a measure of the PSA in light of the overall size of the prostate. And we generally like that number to be less than 0.15. So a lot of times we'll find out that, yes, a man has a PSA of 4, but his prostate on ultrasound is 40 grams, so that would give him a PSA density of 0.1. So we're no longer quite as concerned as we would be with a man who has a prostate of 20 grams with a PSA of 4, whose density would be 0.2.
Okay, so it takes into consideration the size of the overall prostate.
Yes.
And all right, let's go move on. What are the indications for biopsy?
Indications for biopsy would be abnormal rectal examination.
Mm-hmm.
Elevated PSA, greater than 4, typically, although some subscribe to a lower cut point. Any change in the PSA velocity, meaning a PSA that goes up by more than 0.7 in any year. And that would be the main indicators.
Okay. Tell us about some of the findings on biopsy. There's, let's pull back a little bit and ask about how the biopsy is done. Is it the transrectal biopsy we're talking about?
And yes.
Okay. And you normally do an ultrasound with ultrasound guidance?
Yes. It's typically done done in the office, although some urologists will do it in the setting of a surgery center, depending on what their preference is. Usually the man will be asked to do an enema prior to arriving at the office, and then take antibiotics prior to the biopsy. And we use a ultrasound probe, which is usually about the size of two fingers or so, to put in the backside. I preliminarily take some measurements of the prostate to get a volume.
By ultrasound?
Ultrasound, okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then look for any suspicious areas ultrasonographically, such as any dark areas.
Dark areas would be suspicious areas?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, hypoechoic areas, we call them.
Okay.
And then usually we take, the modern technique is usually about 12 biopsies spaced out throughout the prostate.
Okay. And obviously, if there's a dark area or suspicious area, that would include those areas.
Correct. Yeah, you can do additional biopsies directed at any suspicious areas if you feel necessary.
Any risks with doing the biopsy?
The main risk with doing a biopsy is infection. And generally about 1-2% of men who undergo transrectal needle biopsy will end up developing a fever after the procedure, even if they've taken appropriate antibiotic prophylaxis. And in those men, typically we admit them to the hospital and give them some IV antibiotics for a couple days, and it straightens them out.
And is there any risk factor with the biopsy in regard to incontinence or sexual function?
No. Those are some of the misconceptions that we come across. Another common misconception is that you can spread the cancer by doing a biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen a prostate cancer which has spread to the rectum from prostate biopsy. There's no way from a anatomic standpoint that a prostate biopsy is going to cause impotence for somebody.
Okay. And let's say the men who do not have prostate cancer, you do the biopsies, no cancer, then you just resume the annual screening?
Usually I'll follow those men in 6 months, okay, with a repeat PSA and rectal examination, because there can be what's called sampling error when you do a prostate biopsy, meaning, you know, it's kind of like a pin cushion, and you're sticking pins into the cushion, and there can certainly be areas where you don't sample the cancerous area. So you want to follow those men in 6 months, make sure the PSA is not rapidly increasing.
Okay. What are the findings you can have on an abnormal prostate biopsy?
Well, in an ideal world, you'd either have normal or cancer, but in reality, there are basically three subdivisions. You can have a completely normal or benign biopsy, you can have cancer, or you can have something in the middle. There's a condition called PIN, or prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia, which is thought to be a precancerous condition that men can get. And those men just have to be followed a little closer.
On those patients, I'm very interested because the notion of intraepithelial neoplasia in the OBGYN world, where you have cervical intraepithelial neoplasia, in the eye world, where you have conjunctival and ocular surface intraepithelial neoplasia, sometimes we can use medications like topical chemotherapies, and I published a paper back in 1994, use of topical interferon to eradicate conjunctival intraepithelial neoplasia. Is there any work at all being done on the application of maybe injection or other medical therapy for that diagnosis of prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia?
Yes, the primary work regarding that is the use of medicines called 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, which would be, there's two commercially available compounds, finasteride and dutasteride, which go by the trade names of Proscar and Avodart. Those medications may reduce your risk of PIN progressing to prostate cancer. We know that based on a large trial, called the REDUCE trial, that dutasteride does reduce the risk of developing prostate cancer by 25%. But the enrollees in that trial were not PIN patients. They were just screened population.
So there is work in that area. Is there work for these patients, with these PIN patients in particular?
I'm not aware that that was an arm in the trial, but I know, you know, just anecdotally that a lot of urologists use that in an off-label indication for men who have PIN who want to do something to reduce their risk of developing frank carcinoma.
If they don't do that, what other approaches or what other recommendations are used for PIN or prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia or pre-cancer?
Well, it's evolved quite a bit, actually, since the initial time that PIN was described, back in the late 80s, early 90s. It used to be that men would undergo immediate biopsy, and then they would undergo multiple frequent biopsies until cancer was discovered. But over time, we're kind of becoming a little less paranoid about PIN, and usually we'll follow these men up at 6 months with a repeat PSA and rectal exam, and if things aren't changing, then we don't re-biopsy automatically.
Okay, so that's so PIN, prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia, is frequently monitored.
Yes.
Okay, and so we have benign. These are findings on biopsies: benign, frank cancer, PIN, prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia, and is there something also called ASAP?
Yes. ASAP is atypical small acinar proliferation, and that's generally treated like PIN. Okay. It's a precancerous condition.
All right. Is there any other findings that you might receive from the pathologist?
Occasionally we'll get a report of prostatitis. Okay. Sometimes that can show up on the biopsy. But those are the main ones.
Okay. Okay, it is 1:56, and we have covered just about everything except for treatment. So we have, what, 1 or 2 minutes? 2 minutes to go. All right, let's do this, Chandler, if you're willing. Let's hold off on extensive discussion of treatment, maybe to another show,
okay,
if you're willing. And at this time, let's just take the last minute or two to discuss take-home messages for patients concerned about prostate cancer.
Okay. I think the take-home message is to know your numbers, so to speak. If you're over the age of 40, know what your PSA is. Have a yearly rectal examination. It's something that's feared by a lot of men, but it's really painless, and it's something that can be done by a primary care physician. And if you have an abnormality, see a urologist, because we're not scary guys, and we can help guide you through the decision-making process with regard to your PSA. You're not automatically going to get a procedure if you walk in the door. And I would say when it comes to your PSA that it should be interpreted with caution.
And the other thing is you cannot get a PSA density without having an ultrasound of the prostate, and that typically would occur in the office of a urologist.
Correct.
And that information seems to me is crucial, because looking at the PSA without understanding the size of your prostate, you have incomplete information to evaluate what that PSA really means.
I agree, and I would never argue with a patient who had an elevated PSA and asked me, hey, would you mind measuring my prostate so we can have some more information to help guide the decision making?
Excellent. I'd like to thank Dr. Chandler Dora from St. Joseph's Hospital here in Tampa, Florida, for joining me today to discuss prostate cancer. We will schedule Dr. Dora back for a discussion of treatment of prostate cancer. In the meantime, this is Dr. Steve Maskin wishing you a wonderful and healthy week. Next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio Health Care Clinic, we'll be discussing atopic disease, which is in the